You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
What we're going to be looking at is our passage of the week this weekend, which comes to us in Luke 16. We'll look at it in a moment, but what this is a parable, and it's called oftentimes the parable of the dishonest manager. You know, Jesus was a storyteller. That's how he would teach predominantly, is by giving what we call parables. This was common to Jewish rabbis, is they would tell stories, and Jesus was no different. So in the Gospels, we find several dozen parables that Jesus gives. Luke, in particular, gives us a lot of his parables. But out of all of these stories, all of these parables that Jesus gives, this one right here, the parable of the dishonest manager, I believe is the least known, the least appreciated, the least preached on. And I think the big reason why is because it's hard for people to understand. A lot of times when we read this particular parable, it leaves people scratching their heads wondering, what is this all about? And we just kind of move on and forget about it. And I think we can do a little better than that tonight, but it does mean we have a little bit of work to do. So before I even read the text, I want to say something that's very important as we interpret this parable. And you'll hear me say this more than once tonight, I'm sure. But as we read the parable of the dishonest manager, you need to understand that what this is not is a morality tale. And if you interpret it as if it is a morality tale, it will leave you hopelessly confused. Jesus, when he gives you this parable, he's not trying to teach you about right and wrong and how to be a moral person and how to behave. That is not his topic. He is simply giving us this parable to draw us into and reveal to us something about the curious world of grace. And that's the title of the sermon this weekend, The Curious World of Grace. Let's look at it. Chapter 16 of Luke, verse 1. Then Jesus said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. So he summoned him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. Then the manager said to himself, what will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, how much do you owe my master? He answered, 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly and make it 50. Then he asked another, how much do you owe? He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. There you have it. The parable of the dishonest manager. So what do we say about all of that? Well, I have a lot to say about it tonight. But I think maybe we start here. I think this is maybe the most important thing we can do as we begin interpreting the parable, is we should understand that this parable is not told in a vacuum. There's something that prompts this parable. In fact, what you ought to know is that this parable is taught immediately following the parable of the prodigal son. Now, the shame is they are divided into two different chapters. The parable of the prodigal son comes to us at the end of Luke 15. The parable of the dishonest manager is at the beginning of Luke 16. Now, in case you don't know, chapters and verses were added hundreds of years later They later on added chapters and verses, and I'm grateful for that because it is a reference tool. But one of the challenges, one of the problems of putting these two parables into separate chapters is it can lead us to believe that they are disassociated from one another and that Jesus has somehow, for some reason, changed the subject, and that's not the case. Let me show you the last verse of Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal son. Look at verse, I think it's 32. This is when the father receives his prodigal son and throws a big celebration, but the older brother is out in the fields. He doesn't want to get involved, and he's resenting the fact that they're celebrating the return of the prodigal son when he never left. Nobody's ever celebrated him, and so he's pouting about it, and look at what the father tells his older son. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found. The very next verse is chapter 16, verse 1, where Jesus begins the parable of the dishonest manager. Now, at first glance, this heartwarming story about a prodigal son being welcomed home by his loving father may seem to have absolutely nothing to do with this story about a devious and conniving manager. And yet, they actually have a lot in common. And this is the brilliance of Jesus as a storyteller. But I want you to notice some of the similarities between these two parables. We're going to delve into the story here in just a moment. But I want to call your attention to this, that first of all, in both the parable of the prodigal son and the parable of the dishonest manager, we have a person who betrays a trust. They both waste or squander or misuse the possessions of another. One is failed at being a son. The other is failed at being a manager. In both cases, they will either be saved by mercy or they won't be saved at all. In the end of both parables, one of them receives an unexpected party. The other receives an unexpected commendation. And in both stories, they both pull us into the beautiful and curious world of grace. Okay, so here's the story. There's a rich man. And by the way, that seems to be how Jesus begins a lot of his parables. There was a rich man. There was a rich man who owned a lot of land, and his wealth was tied to his land. Let's give our rich landowner a name, and we'll call him Mr. Spencer. Mr. Spencer owns a lot of land. And what he ends up doing is he rents out his land to tenant farmers. So these are people who live on the land and they work the land. They get to keep a large portion of what they produce, but they also have to pay rent, and they pay their rent in the form of produce. So for example, we meet a couple examples of guys who one of them pays in measures of olive oil, the other one pays in measures of wheat. So Mr. Spencer, once again, the rich landowner, he has all these tenant farmers who live and work the land, and they pay rent to him in the form of produce. But Mr. Spencer has so much land and rents it out to so many tenant farmers, he decides he's going to hire a manager to oversee the operation. Rather than him taking up all his time to deal with all these tenant farmers, he says, I'm just going to hire somebody. And that person will oversee the operation, make sure everybody pays their rent on time, and take care of any concerns that might arise. So Mr. Spencer hires, we would call him a property manager. And we're going to give him a name as well. We'll call him Oscar. So Oscar, the manager, Mr. Spencer, the landowner. Well, it turns out that Oscar is a crook. And in the parable, it just simply says he's been squandering the owner's property. Probably what's been happening is he's got some type of embezzlement scheme happening. You know, as people are paying their rent, their produce, he takes a little bit of olive oil and keeps it on the side and sells it separate from everything else and keeps the money for himself. He's making extra money off of Mr. Spencer's property. So he's got a little fraudulent scheme happening on the side. Well, eventually Oscar's scheme gets found out. Somebody reports it, and Mr. Spencer learns about Oscar's conniving scheme. And so Mr. Spencer calls in Oscar and says, Oscar, I want to let you know I know all about this ruse you've been playing, and you are fired. And before you leave, I want you to turn in the books. I want to see a full accounting of how you've been mishandling everything. So now Oscar is very troubled. He's very alarmed. He's disturbed. He's panicking. He's thinking about his own future. And he's like, man, I'm not even sure what I'm going to do now. Like, I can't work manual labor. I'm just not that kind of guy. I'm not equipped for that. And I don't want to be reduced to being a beggar. But it's not like I can collect unemployment or anything. There's nothing like that. So you don't work, you don't eat in that culture. So he's really alarmed about his own well-being. He's not sure what he's going to do. He's quite desperate. And so Oscar hatches a plan. And it's actually a brilliant plan. Not a morally upright plan, but it is clever. And you're going to see in a moment how complex it is. It might sound simple when you first hear about it, but there's actually another layer of complexity here. He's got a really well thought out, clever idea. And here's how it goes down. One by one, Oscar meets with each one of these tenant farmers. And he just sits down with each one of them, one by one. And he says, hey, Bob, what do you owe in rent? What do you pay in rent? And he says, in the books here, according to the books, it says you owe 100 measures of olive oil. Is that correct? Yes, it's correct. Well, he said, here's the thing. You know, I met with Mr. Spencer the other day, and I was explaining to him how hard things are for people. People are having a difficult time, and really, we ought to cut him a break. And I was able to convince Mr. Spencer to cut your rent. And from this point on, no longer do you have to pay 100 measures of olive oil. You only have to pay 50. And of course, Bob is just beaming with joy. He's beside himself. Oh, Oscar, thank you so much. I can't believe this. And make sure you extend my gratitude to Mr. Spencer as well. Man, this is going to change my life and my family's lives. Wow, what a blessing. Thank you, Oscar, for being such a great friend. And then he meets with another guy and says, hey, how much do you owe in rent? According to books, it says you owe 100 measures of wheat. Is that correct? Yes. And he tells him the same thing. I was talking with Mr. Spencer. Times are tough. We ought to cut people a break. Mr. Spencer, he's so generous. He's going to slash your rent. You don't have to pay 100 measures of wheat. From now on, you pay 80 measures of wheat. And by the way, just as an aside, I thought this was interesting. 20 measures of wheat and 50 measures of oil, even though they're different amounts, they were worth about the same in that culture. So he's giving them the same discount. So what's Oscar doing? Well, he's ingratiating himself to these tenant farmers and leading them to believe that Mr. Spencer, the landlord, is incredibly kind and generous and merciful. Think about how this would make you feel if you were one of those farmers. And for some of you, you don't even have to think too hard. It's easy to transpose this into your life right now. Maybe you're here and you are renting an apartment or renting a house here in Burbank or in Studio City or North Hollywood or wherever. You're renting like so many people do. And there's a property manager that you have to deal with, and you pay this person, and some rich landowner owns all this real estate, but you deal with the property manager, and one day you're sitting in your place, and there's a knock at the door, and you see it's the property manager, and your heart sinks, and you get really tense, because this never goes well. This is always bad news. But the property manager explains to you good news. I was talking with the owner of this establishment, and I'm just going to tell you, we decided, it's just really tough on people right now in this economy, and the owner decided to cut you a break. And they're going to slash your rent so every month you can pay $1,000 less. How would that make you feel? That would change your life. That would make your year. Might make your decade, right? That's how these tenant farmers feel. That night, they're going to throw a party. And they're going to toast Mr. Spencer, the most generous landlord in town. And they're going to toast Oscar, who always has our back. So everything's going great. But eventually, Oscar's plan once again gets discovered, and Mr. Spencer learns about what he's been doing. But you see, here's the thing, and this is why it gets a little complex. Oscar was always counting on that. He knew he was going to get found out. He wanted to eventually get found out because his whole plan depends on getting found out. Because what he's been doing here is a high-stakes gamble. He's rolling the dice here. If everything goes his way, he's going to get saved. He won't have to work manual labor. He won't have to become a beggar. He'll just win all of these friends, and he'll be able to move from house to house. But if everything goes wrong, well, then the opposite's going to happen, and Oscar's going to go to jail. So this is a high-stakes gamble. He's betting everything on how Mr. Spencer's going to respond to all of this. So Mr. Spencer learns about Oscar's plan, and now the onus is on Mr. Spencer because he's got a choice to make, and he's got really one of two options. On one hand, he could go really hard on Oscar and have him sent to jail. He could do that, but then he's also got to go to all of these tenant farmers and have this difficult conversation and explain to each one of them, listen, I know that Oscar came to you, had a conversation, claimed that I made this generous decision to slash your rent, and I know it made your day, and you guys all threw a party, and you love me, and you sing my praises, but I just have to let you know that it's not true. Oscar lied to you. He did not have my authorization, and so you're going to have to actually continue paying the full amount. He could do that. That's a perfectly viable option. Or Mr. Spencer can say, oh, man, that Oscar is so clever. He's so smart. I don't like him. He's dishonest. He's a crook. But wow, that was brilliant because now he's painted me into a corner. He's put me in a tough spot. And man, I think I'm just going to enjoy this new reputation of being kind and generous and merciful because I don't want to have to go to all these people and explain to them this was all a ruse and break their hearts. So I think I'm going to let them all get away with it for the sake of my new reputation of being kind and generous and gracious. It's a crazy story. It's a brilliant scheme, but it's high stakes because Oscar is betting everything on one thing, that Mr. Spencer truly is, in his heart of hearts, he truly is kind and generous and merciful. Because if Mr. Spencer is not kind and generous and merciful, then Oscar's just made his situation a whole lot worse and he's going to jail. So it is a crazy story. Now, if you're sitting here confused still, it's because you're still coming to this parable with that paradigm of assuming that this parable is trying to teach you about morality. And if you try to turn this story into a lesson, a Sunday school lesson about how we should behave and what morality looks like, then you run into the problem of Jesus here commending a crook for crooked behavior. Which, by the way, about 1,700 years ago, there was a Roman emperor named Julian the Apostate. And Julian hated Christianity. This was after Constantine and the empire became Christian. Julian hated Christianity, and he wanted to try to steer the empire away from Christianity and return it back to being a pagan empire. And Julian the Apostate loved this parable, and he would quote it to Christians, and he would say, Christians, you see, this Jesus who you love and believe in and worship, turns out he's not so morally upright because he's here commending somebody who's being dishonest. And you see, that's when we pulled Julian aside and explained to him, Julian, you're mistaken. This parable is not about right or wrong. It's not trying to teach you about morality. It's trying to introduce you to the curious world of God's grace. Remember, this story is told right after these three parables about lost things in Luke 15. And we talked about all of that last week. And remember, this whole barrage of parables are told in a response to something. Jesus had been sitting down, sharing a meal with sinners, with all these disreputable people. And the Pharisees, the religious leaders, were scandalized by it, and they were grumbling about it. I can't believe that Jesus would dare to share a meal with sinners. And Jesus, in response, tells four parables in a row. The parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, the parable of the prodigal son, and then this really edgy one about a dishonest, conniving manager who gambles everything on grace. And you see, this is why I think this might have something to do with the reason why sinners all the time were attracted to Jesus. You ever notice in the Gospels that sinners were comfortable around Jesus? They were attracted to him. They found Jesus a welcoming presence. Now, It's not the case that Jesus here is commending sin, and neither am I. But I'll tell you this, self-proclaimed sinners, that is, people who understand, apart from God's mercy, I am a sinner and I have nothing to stand on. They have a kind of advantage when it comes to Jesus. And that is they understand that if I'm ever going to make it with God, I'm going to have to make it by grace and mercy. God's just going to have to be good to me because I'm a sinner. But good people, self-assumed good people, struggle with that idea. It's more like in their heads, like, man, I'm a good guy. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I keep all the rules. And they don't say it just so, because we've learned not to say it. But underneath all of that lurks this idea that, you know what, God pretty much owes me to treat me well. And it never works like that. So here's what Jesus understood. Jesus understood that there's a sense in which sinners, self-proclaimed, self-admitted, I know that I'm a no-good scoundrel sinner. There's a sense in which sinners are smarter than the sons of light. The sons of light, in other words, those people who call themselves and consider themselves, and maybe even society considers them to be good, upright, and moral, the sons of light are constantly tempted to try to get by on their own good behavior. Whereas the sinners know that the only hope they have is the mercy and grace of God. And that's how Jesus wants us to think, that it's smarter for you and me to bet on God's mercy than on our goodness. It's more intelligent to bet the farm on God's mercy than it is your morality. So what do we say? We have to resist the temptation to make Christianity a religion of moralism for do-gooders. Christianity is not a religion where do-gooders get by on their doing good. Now, is Christianity a religion where people just remain immoral and dishonest? No, far be it. But again, that's not even the point of the parable. That's not even what Jesus is thinking about here, is teaching you how to behave. That's not the topic here. I may comment on that, but Jesus doesn't. That's not the subject of the parable. But I'll say this much. The whole Pharisee mentality was, first of all, you need to behave. Get your life in order. Your behavior needs to line up with this list of do's and don'ts. You need to start behaving right. Then you need to start believing right. We need to get your doctrine straight. And if you'll behave right, and then if you'll believe right, then you can belong. That was the Pharisee paradigm. Behave, believe, then you can belong. Jesus comes around and says, let's turn that table upside down. And he says, first of all, just come and be at my table. Come and take a seat. Sit down with me. You belong. Come and be a part of this. Come share a meal with me. Because Jesus understands, Zacchaeus, if you're going to be around me long enough, Jesus, if you're going to get around Jesus long enough, you'll come to believe upon him. And having believed upon him, sooner or later, you're going to find things in your life changing and transforming. The way you think and the way you relate to people, sooner or later, is going to gradually begin to change. It's not behave, believe, belong. It's belong, believe, and then everything begins to transform. And that's a lifelong expedition. So what is Christianity? Well, I could say it like this. Christianity is the high-stakes gamble of betting everything on the mercy of God and coming up big. And how many of you can testify to that? Like, I've bet big time on the mercy of God, and I have found out that I could win. And I'll let you in on a little secret. The dice are loaded. Because God is good. And God is merciful. And I don't care who you are. I don't care how screwed up your life is. You bet on the mercy of God, you're going to win that bet. And there's a table here. And Jesus is inviting you to come to his table tonight, the table of communion. Sometimes I hear people say things like, well, I just wish I lived in the days of Jesus. I wish I lived in Jesus' time so that I could share a meal with him. Well, guess what? You're living in the days of Jesus right now, and he's got a table to invite you to. It's not my table. It's not the church's table. It's Jesus' table. And he'll share a meal with anybody who will come. You just come with that attitude that says, I'm a sinner in need of God's mercy, and you're qualified to come and share his table.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.